As we mentioned earlier today, the phrase, your days are numbered, finds some of its origins in Daniel chapter 5, but there's also another phrase that we still use that's even, it's more of the phrase of Daniel chapter 5 than that one is, and this one really is its origin. Does anyone happen to know what phrase this is? If you know what story Daniel chapter 5 is, if you know the phrase that comes out of it that we still use today. The writing on the wall. That's the story we're in today. That writing on the wall. And would you believe me if I told you we can pinpoint the exact day that this phrase originated? Like a lot of ancient, a lot of old phrases, like phrases that we use, that like phrases that mean something and it's hard to understand if you're not really a native speaker of that language, or some phrase that only makes sense if you're kind of on in the know. A lot of those, we have no idea when they originated. Like we can pinpoint, this is the first day we found it in a published book. But obviously, if it was put in a published book, it originated before then. And so we don't know when a lot of these phrases started, but I can tell you to the exact day what day the phrase, the writing on the wall, came from, because we can tell you what day Daniel chapter 5 took place. That's pretty good for a 3,000, almost 3,000-year-old story, right? That we can say which day it took place on, and that is the 15th of Tashritu, which is mid-October. So mid-October, the 15th of Tashritu, and I know that because I have I can tell you a neat little history lesson that has to do with Daniel chapter 5. Now, granted, our chapter still makes sense without knowing this history, and the history isn't included in the Bible, but I just think it's interesting because it gives some extra context and some cool thoughts to this and kind of grounds it in history. But I've got a map to show you up here. This is what Nebuchadnezzar's territory was when Nebuchadnezzar was around. But in between Daniel chapter 4 and Daniel chapter 5, Nebuchadnezzar dies and about six kings happen, and then you get to Daniel chapter 5. It's interesting the Bible doesn't include any of that, but actually quite a bit historically happens between Daniel chapter 4 and Daniel chapter 5. You can see all of that area. Do you recognize where we are in the world? That's like, I'll walk over here and point even. Here's Jerusalem, even though it's hard to see from over out in the pews, I guess. And then here's a zoomed up one. So Jerusalem, you know where that is kind of on the map. It's that area. Modern day Iraq is over here. Babylon's kind of the same thing, the region wise. And so this is the area. Now the orange line, though, that's the expanse of the Babylonian Empire during Daniel chapter 5. So it shrunk quite a bit because the guys up to the north, the Medo-Persians, are like the big bad guys looming on the scene. Now, something happened on the 14th of Tashritu. We know the 15th of Tashritu is Daniel chapter 5, but the 14th, something kind of crazy for Babylon happened. You can see that top city is Opis. A few days earlier, Opis fell to the Medo-Persians. The 14th of Tashritu, Sippar, that next city down, it didn't even fight. It just gave up. The Medo-Persian army came and they said, hey, welcome, we don't want to die. That's what the Sippar people happened. And that's the 14th of Tashritu, and the 15th is when Daniel chapter 5 takes place. Most likely, scouts came overnight and came riding into Babylon saying, the Persians are coming, the Persians are coming, watch out. And to give some context, see that orange line next to the three cities? That's about the distance between Rolla and St. Louis. And so, you can see they're pretty close. Like, you're not too far from St. James when you're talking Sippar there. But there's some context there. The enemy is literally outside the gates during Daniel chapter 5. Like, there's literally surrounding the city at this point that Daniel chapter 5 takes place. The Bible doesn't actually mention that, but it's they're under siege while this story is taking place. And I think that is interesting. And so while this is going on, say you're the ruler of Babylon, what do you do? You throw a wild party, of course, because that's what happened here. He decides to party like it's 1999 BC, and Daniel chapter 5 goes on. You can tell that he's probably feeling some tension. He's probably a little bit stressed out. You know, his cities are falling left and right like flies, and he's chilling out in Babylon, and he's kind of just waiting for whatever is going to happen. And so it seems like he turns to drinking is what happens here in this text. And what's interesting is all of the same themes from Daniel's chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4 repeat themselves, thematically at least, not all the details, but the themes repeat themselves in Daniel chapter 5. But so far, we've seen a lot of tension on the people of God and how this tension is strong on those who want to live for the Lord in the society, but it's kind of flipped on its head in Daniel chapter 5. All the tension, when Daniel walks into the scene, he doesn't have any tension at all. He's just like, hey, yeah, what's up? But the bad guy, the ruler, he's the one who's got all kinds of tension on his shoulders, and you can see that play out as we get to it. Another interesting thing about this story is that up until the mid-1800s, people thought Daniel chapter 5, some people, thought it was just a complete made-up fairy tale. Like, they thought it didn't make any sense. The reason why is because we have records of all of the Babylonian kings, pretty good records of them, actually. And nowhere in all the records we had did we have Belshazzar. And it wasn't like there was a chunk of time that was missing, and it's like, oh, he might have fallen into the chunk of time. It's no, we had the succession order. Here's a king, here's a king, here's a king, here's a king. And by the way, there's no Belshazzar, so the Bible's wrong, is what a lot of people were thinking, until the mid-1800s, and then we found this little cylinder called the Nabonidus cylinder. And in there, we get the story about Nabonidus, who's the king, who is the last one before the Mede-Persians take over Babylon, which is what's about to happen in the story. And he's got this son whose name is Belshazzar. And we also know that he lets his son rule in his place when he's on a 10-year vacation in Arabia. And so he's not like the king, but he's the king in his father's stead because he's hundreds of miles away when his kingdom falls. And so you can see that he's the king. The Bible's not dishonest or anything. The Bible knew what it was talking about. Because there's this other guy who's the technical king, but he's not doing any ruling, and so his son is ruling in his stead. That's what's going on there. That also makes sense of later in the chapter we're going to see where it says that Belshazzar promises whoever interprets the writing on the wall, they can be third in the kingdom. It's because that's the best he could do. He couldn't make him second in the kingdom because he was second in the kingdom. And so that's actually, hey, Bible actually interprets itself if you know the history right. So, but there's that. We also have another problem looking at this text historically, though, and it's not a huge problem, and it's that Belshazzar is named Nebuchadnezzar's son in Daniel chapter 5. Now, we know that about six kings took place, though, between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and so you're like, how do we make sense of that? Because it says it several times that he's the son, and Nebuchadnezzar's his father, but remember, people in antiquity, when they're making a genealogy, they just didn't care about skipping generations if those generations didn't pertain to their story. We actually see this in the Bible genealogy. You can compare one genealogy to another genealogy in the Bible, and when you compare them, either someone added generations or someone left out generations. That happens. It's because people, back in the day, if you weren't important to the story, you just weren't included in the story. And that especially happened with kings. You are perfectly fine back in the day calling someone son, even if they're like six generations removed, because he's your kingly father. Do you understand that idea? So it's more like predecessor and ancestor when you see son or father in there. It's a very loose term because it's not wrong. It's just that's how they wrote back then. They weren't so precise with genealogies as we think you have to be. They just cared about the important parts. But going back to the main history lesson, though, we see that the enemy is literally at the gates. Right now, you might remember me, if you were here last week, talking about the walls of Babylon. They're one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. Very massive walls. It was big enough for a four-horse chariot to do donuts on the top and not fall off the side. So you can understand a little bit why Belshazzar might not be so worried about enemies being at the gates, because he's in Babylon. It's got the best walls that's ever been known to man at the time. Turns out, though, Darius the Mede figured out how to cut off the flow of the Euphrates, which went under the wall to give water to the city, and if you stop the flow of the water, you can just march right on that ground where the water used to be, and then pop up, and surprise, that's what happened historically. And that, we know, happened on the 15th of Tashritu. We also know from non-biblical texts that it happened during a party in the castle, like in the king's house, which, hey, that lines up with what Daniel chapter 5 says happened. But we do know that tensions would have been high in the court. You have to ask, is it because the armies are gathered outside? Is that why he had the party? Was it to rally his leaders? Was it to let off some tension? Was it to kind of like get the help of the gods so they had this big idolatry party? Maybe they feasted today because they figured, hey, we're going to die tomorrow. Maybe Belshazzar is just an idiot. We don't know what the reason was. Maybe it's all of those combined or just some of them. But enough talking about the story. Let's actually read the story. And so I will read out of Daniel chapter 5. Hey, I opened up right to Daniel, and I don't have it marked. That's handy. Daniel chapter 5, I'll start in verse 1, and we'll read the first four verses to start with. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Now, it's interesting that none of the history lesson I just shared with you is in there. It just sort of just like a verse before it was Nebuchadnezzar. It's like, hey, here's this Belshazzar guy, and let's start talking about what happens in his party. It ignores all that, but I just think it's interesting context. But the details that we do have in here, though, are that Belshazzar really seems like he wants to specifically attack the God of the Hebrews for some reason. He wants to go after them. And I'm thinking maybe he was angry at the dream of his father, Nebuchadnezzar, because if you remember from several chapters back, Nebuchadnezzar had the funky dream, the head of gold, the chest of other stuff, and so on and so. And the interpretation was that your dynasty is going to end. There's going to be more dynasties after you. And so maybe while the enemy are at his gates, he's actually kind of angry at this prophecy from the God of the Bible. And he's like, I'm not too thrilled with this idea that my dynasty is going to end. So maybe there's that. So he wants to attack him. Maybe the Pitly King wants his revenge on the God who prophesied that his dynasty is going to end. I don't know. But we do know that he's got all of his lords and ladies and wives and concubines, and they all participate in blasphemy against God altogether. The goblets and the other items of the temple, they're just objects, but it was the meaning behind him taking those objects and doing what he did with them. They were things set apart for God's service, and he's using them for the complete opposite of God's service, to celebrate other gods. And so that's not something that God exactly looks favorably at. He might have had thoughts like, I'm going to show those crummy rulers before me. You know, no God's bounty is off limits. No conquered people's God should be feared. Babylon's not going to fall. Well, look at this God we toppled, this one whose goblets we're drinking out of, and they say he beat the Egyptians. So you know what? We're going to just drink out of his goblets and show we can beat anybody. That might have been some of the thoughts going through his head. I don't know, but instead he worships gods of gold and stone and iron and bronze, not steel. But then the real God shows up. Something appears. This hand appears and starts writing on the wall, which is the weirdest thing ever. Why didn't just the writing appear on the wall? That would have been weird enough. Why did the hand appear and start writing on the wall? Finally figured out, I was reading one book, and it says that actually a severed hand was the sign of you're gonna die. It's like when you like send someone a dead fish because you're in the mafia. It's sort of like that. It's like when you see a severed hand, like, if you conquered someone and then sent them something to show I'm going to get you next, you'd send, like, one of your enemy's hands with the enemy. So a severed hand was an omen of I'm going to take you out is the omen here. And so it's a funky culture. I'm glad we don't share severed hands. But that's what was going on there with this. And so this human-looking hand starts writing on the wall, and that's in these next verses, verses 5 through 9. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men in Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. All right, so knowing the enemy's at your gates, a severed hand shows up, starts writing on your wall. That's going to make you get a little panicky, a little jumpy, I would think. We aren't revealed what the inscription is yet, but regardless, we know that no one can read it, so it doesn't matter at this point in the story. We read that the king's face loses its color, his limbs gave way, his knees start knocking together. It's very much like a cartoon of someone who's scared. But what's funny, though, is the Hebrew's it's a little more ambiguous than our English translation, because when it says his limbs gave way, it might have meant, like, his bladder region gave way. So I just really like the image of this king who just wet himself. That's very funny to me. And that actually could be a possible translation, but we don't know. Either way, it's just whatever stereotypically is someone being afraid, that's what's going on here. And so he is panicked. And in this moment of crisis, we read that the queen shows up, which is weird because a few verses earlier it said that the wives were all there and all of his concubines were there too, engaged in this party with him. So we don't know who this queen is exactly. It's probably not Belshazzar's wife because all of his wives were already there. It was probably a wife of an earlier king. It might be Nabonidus' wife. We don't know. Well, we know it's not Nabonidus' wife because she died a few years earlier before this text takes place. It could be Nebuchadnezzar's wife because even though there's like six kings changed over, all within the same dynasty, they were all really short reigns. And so Nebuchadnezzar's wife still could be alive. And if it is, Greek historians actually venerated her wisdom. But regardless of who it was, we don't know who this person was, except that she's a queen. She comes up with the right answer, and that is go get Daniel. That's the answer that she comes up with. And so we'll see that in verses 10 through 16. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king," I feel like she's saying that to be like, you're not a real king, buddy. But "your father the king made him chief of the musicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom my king the father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show me the interpretation of the matter. But I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now, if you remember the exchanges between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, this one plays out a lot differently than the exchanges between those two guys. It seemed like Daniel actually had a pretty healthy respect for Nebuchadnezzar. Every time he spoke to him, he started off with, "Oh, king, live forever. You're so cool. I wish that this prophecy wasn't coming true." That's not the way it reads as Daniel starts to speak in this next one. And you can tell that Belshazzar is kind of a jerk because the first thing he talks about is like, "Oh, yeah, you're one of those exiles that we conquered. Oh, yeah, I've heard you're pretty good. You know, if you can do it, yeah, I'll give you stuff." Like, that's the way it kind of reads. It's maybe not that strong, but that's the sentiment going on here. He doesn't compliment Daniel. He just says, "I've heard things about you." And then also notice that Belshazzar is using Daniel's real name, probably because Daniel's pagan name is Belteshazzar, which sounds a whole lot like the king's name, so he's probably not too thrilled about using it. But it's ironic because Daniel's real name means "my judge is God," and he's about to be judged by God, and so the irony there is good. But let's read that judgment from God in verses 17 and following. "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty, and because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. Whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of the beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So first, Daniel starts out by talking about how cool your granddaddy was and how he had like all the power, but you don't, Belshazzar. That's how he starts talking to him. But then he does that for a reason, though. He says, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, he had some shortcomings, but he got past them because he decided to believe in the Lord. But you have not, Nebuchadnezzar, and you've gone in the direct opposite direction. Daniel rejects the reward, but seems all too happy, though, to go and give the interpretation for free. And so he talks to this inexperienced second-rate king who's partying the night that there's an army camped outside of his house, and it's almost like the writing was on the wall before the writing was ever literally on the wall. And then we finally learn the words, what they are. Mene, mene, tekel, uparsin. And these words are a transliteration of the words, not a translation. Do you know the difference between transliterating and translating? All right, I've got the words on the screen, at least what they look like in modern Hebrew script. Anyone want to try to read that? For one, it goes the other direction. And I got rid of the spaces in the vowels because they didn't invent spaces and vowels for the Hebrew language until the 1400s AD. Not BC, AD. There were no spaces and vowels. And so that is Hebrew script. Well, this looks a lot neater. Ancient Hebrew script looked a lot more like chicken scratch, if you can believe that. But that is mene, mene, tekel, uparsin. To transliterate something is what you do with like a lot of people's names. Daniel, that's his name transliterated. My judge is God, that's his name translated. So when you transliterate something, you just take the characters from the other script and put them into your English script, and then you say what that word sounds like, and that's transliterating. And so Daniel does that. He transliterates the words, and that's what we have in our Bibles, is the non-English words. So they're transliterated. But then you translate them, which we don't have in our Bibles, but if you translate the words, then you get mina, mina, shekel, and a half. That's the words translated, which is kind of weird. Like, that's the message that God has for this king, is like dollar, dollar, coin, and a quarter. Like, that's the words here, the translated here. But Daniel goes a step further. He doesn't just transliterate. He doesn't just translate. He interprets, which we all have to kind of do a lot of times, even when we have something translated for us. You've got to interpret. And Daniel's able to interpret it rightly, and he says it's not just dollar, dollar, bill, y'all. It's numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided is what he says are the interpretations. Now, he says the numbered, and he said the numbered, that word is used twice. Numbered, God has numbered your days, is the first thing he says. Next is weighed, and he says, you've been judged and weighed on the scales, but you've been left wanting. And then divided, he says, your kingdom's going to be divided and taken away from you. All that over four words that didn't have spaces, they're all kind of one big word. And it comes to fruition in the next verses. Verse 29 through 31 are, then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him, that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Honestly, I'm really not sure of verse 29, like, what was the reasoning behind there. We realize Daniel getting these prizes really meant absolutely nothing, because that night the dynasty changes. But Daniel didn't ask for them anyway. But I'm like, did he give them to him because he's like, oh, I'm a king, I can't take back my word, or did he do it just because he's drunk and has no idea what's going on? I don't know. But Daniel gets the prizes, even though he's getting prizes for saying, you're going to die tonight, is what he's telling him. But you notice what doesn't come, though, what doesn't come from Belshazzar is any form of repentance whatsoever. He just lives up his end of the bargain, and then that's all we see. And then Darius the Mede, who we're going to learn more about next week, because King Darius was the Daniel in the Lion's Den king. We're going to talk about him next week. But Darius takes over the throne of Babylon. It's no longer a Chaldean dynasty. It's now a Median Persian dynasty. And that's a pretty lengthy history lesson, right? I mean, I've been talking for a while. It's a long history lesson. It's a good Bible lesson. But then you got to ask, okay, beyond the history lesson, beyond the Bible lesson, what's the life lesson? Because the Bible's not just written to be a nice story time, even though it has some really cool stories in it. But that's not it. I mean, is the lesson supposed to be just don't be an idiot like Belshazzar? Like, is it just supposed to be, I mean, we've heard the rhyme, don't run, don't chew, don't, or no, what is it, don't dance, don't chew, don't run with girls that do? So maybe the lesson out of this chapter is supposed to be don't blaspheme, don't boast, don't party with God's goblets at an idol roast. I wrote that myself. But I think there's a deeper lesson than that, than just, you know, don't mess up like Belshazzar. Granted, it's a story of judgment. And that's what it is. It's a story of being judged by God. It's a story that should make us look at ourselves and say, am I worthy of God's judgment? And where do I weigh on the scales? But sadly, most of us, when an area of life that needs God's judgment the most is when we often have too rosy-colored of glasses about ourselves the most. And then many of us, even if we said, okay, yeah, I'll try and judge myself, we have no idea how to look into Scripture and see us reflected back as something that's not weighing out against what's written there. And we'll often not realize that we're really at fault. But one way to bring this out and bring more life to the story, I think, is to ask the question is, do you ever wonder why Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar were judged differently? Daniel chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4 were about Nebuchadnezzar's mistakes, essentially. I mean, that's not what they're about, but Nebuchadnezzar's mistakes are included in there. And he gets forgiven and given extra chances and told, hey, change your ways, king, and then all these good things happen. And Daniel even treats him nicely. But then Belshazzar doesn't do that much different than what Nebuchadnezzar had done in the previous four chapters, and he's judged, and that night he dies. Why were they judged differently? You could argue that, you know, God's really kind of a jerk here because Belshazzar gets one chance and messes up, but Nebuchadnezzar gets a bunch of chances, and then he ends up like, oh, cool, Nebuchadnezzar's a great guy. You could argue that, but here's what I think the difference is, though, and that's that Belshazzar acted contrary to all the evidence from his own life. Nebuchadnezzar, he acted about as good as you could have assumed at first, and he slowly, you see him, he messes up pretty big time a couple times, but at the end of each chapter, he's like, hey, God's actually kind of cool God. And then Daniel chapter 4 is his official proclamation to every peoples and nation and tribe on the earth that you should believe in God, and here's why I do, is Daniel chapter 4. And you better believe that Belshazzar would have heard that official proclamation. If it was like an official proclamation of the king, then yeah, the next king's coming, especially one who's referred to as his son, would have heard his father's legacy and read about that and known about it. But yet Belshazzar fights really hard against it, and he's not even just content with not believing his granddaddy Nebi. He's not content just not believing it. He has to go out and attack it and be contrary to it and go after his father's faith. It wasn't enough to just simply disagree. He had to destroy the image of God that had been built up in Babylon, and so he wants to openly mock him and make all of his lords and ladies participate in mocking him. And that actually sounds a bit like today's culture sometimes, that it's not enough to just disagree, you've got to stop all disagreements. But remember, though, that the tension is not on God's people, and so one lesson we could get out of this is that, hey, even if it seems that way, the tension's on those people. They're the ones who are going to have some judgment. But don't let the tables turn so quickly, though, because the lesson isn't just to make us feel better. There's also a lesson here for ourselves. And that's Nebuchadnezzar didn't do that much different than what would have been expected of him, and he was willing to change for the better. And he ended up being someone who you never would have expected at the beginning of his life. But Belshazzar had already witnessed the truth. He already should have known better, and yet he didn't live up to any of it. In fact, went against it. He might have witnessed his great father Nebuchadnezzar going crazy that you saw in Daniel chapter 4. But if not, he at least read the accounts and heard about it. See, sometimes God's warnings to us are actually God's discipline and God's judgment on other people. Sometimes God's warnings to us are the warnings that we see in other people. Sometimes his warnings to us are the experiences of those who have gone before us, or the histories that have been told to us, or are people wanting to learn how to know better so that we can actually know better without having to live through that. Sometimes that's God's warning to us, and Belshazzar did not listen to God's warning, that Belshazzar would have been trained in as he grew up. Instead, he ignored it. And so the question for us is, do we know better, even with a host of stories and a host of life lessons and a host of experiences all around us, do we know better? Or do we ignore the warnings of scriptures? Do we ignore the warnings of people who've gone before us? Do we think of ourselves just with rose-colored glasses and we boast about how nothing could possibly penetrate the defenses of this great wall around us of all these good deeds that we've done? I mean, you can spin chariots on top of how cool of a person I am, and I will not fall. I mean, even if my walls did come down, then, you know, surely God's not going to let anything happen to me because Scripture says, do not judge, and so I'm probably good, right? Like, that is stuff that we spout off, not necessarily those words, but we spout off stuff like that all the time. God is much more complex than just a simple one-dimensional view of all because he is willing to forgive every sin doesn't mean he's okay with every sin. And just all because God's willing to forgive every sin doesn't mean he doesn't expect us to stop every sin. Like, he's not just one-dimensional. He's a much more complex God than that. He's okay with forgiving every single thing, but he wants those things to come to an end at some point. And he wants you to learn better, and he wants you to know better. He's not just this little tiny piddly God who, like, we can say one little catchphrase about and then we're good. He's much more complex than that. And so one thing that he said once to this guy in Daniel chapter 5 is, Mene, mene, tekel, uparsin. And so your days are numbered, you're left wanting, you will be divided. And we want to ask that about ourselves. Our days are numbered, we know that's true. And we are left wanting. Anytime you rank any of our lives on a scale, then we're left wanting. And the question is, will you be divided? Or will you side with the guy who already has been divided so that he took that judgment and so you do not have to be divided? But if you have taken the side with the man who's been divided in our place, then why aren't you acting like you're on that guy's side? Why aren't you listening to his warning and the warnings of his apostles in the Bible, who have gone before us, who tell us about God's judgment, who tell us how to avoid God's judgment, who tell us when you should do various things? And if you have been united with that man who's been divided for our sakes, been judged for our sakes, then why aren't you telling that to other people? Because if you look around, people are going to be found wanting. So why aren't we sharing that? The enemy is at the gates. It's at the gates in everybody's life. It's at the gates in Belshazzar's life, Daniel chapter 5. It's at the gates in all of our lives. You're a foolish person if you think there's not almost constantly stuff going on that is attempting to harm you. And are you eating and drinking and being merry and partying, or are you joining the side of the one who's already won the war? That's an important question to think about. So please pray with me. God, I thank you for the story of Belshazzar and Daniel in Daniel chapter 5. May we realize that it is not just a story, but it's also the life of someone who died in your judgment. And that is something that should make us have pause and not simply read and be unchanged afterwards, but to actually wrap our heads around someone who died and went to hell. It's really what Daniel chapter 5 is. And so God, please let us take the warning. Let us live differently. Let us realize that we are found wanting, and so instead we should side with you and never want again. Let us side with the one who has been divided and judged for our sakes so that we don't have to be. And let us act like it and share that news. And ask this in Jesus' powerful name. Amen.